on the new lecture. What kind of society is the United States? What kind of society is the United States? That's a it's an interesting kind of question. What kind of society is American society? It's the kind of question that you can ask about anything. It's an example of what's called a classification question. The most familiar setting, I think, for classification questions, perhaps, is biology. You know, you encounter some strange critter, and you can ask, what kind of an animal is this? And because of the success as a science of evolutionary biology, we have very sophisticated ways of answering the question, what kind of an animal is this? And there was a time, for example, when people thought that whales were fishes. Whales were a variety of fish. We know that's not true. Whales are a variety of mammals. Whales and mice have more in common than whales and tuna have in common. Whales are a variety of mammal. That's a classification. And it's a classification which is not arbitrary. It's not just that we say, aha, the whales and mice are both mammals because they have some peculiar property in common. No, this is based on a detailed scientific investigation of the evolution of species, of where the branch points are, of where different families and different subspecies, where all these things occur, and how we classify things is derived from that process. So whales and mice share a common type. Biology is pretty sophisticated in this. Sociology, I think, has a less well-ordered way of classifying societies. There's no universal consensus about how to classify societies in the case of sociology in the way that there is in biology. Or take chemistry. We have the periodic table of elements. Well, that's a fantastically sophisticated, coherent, and systematic way of classifying things. What kind of material is this? You find something, aha, let's go to the periodic table and figure out what the elements that form the compound is. In answering the question, what kind of society is American society, there are really three steps that we have to go through. First, we have to figure out what are the main dimensions in terms of which societies vary. There are countless different dimensions on which societies could vary that one might imagine are important. What are the main categories or types on each dimension? So you could have a classification system which says one of the dimensions on which societies vary is the kind of economy they have. And then you have to ask the second question, well, what are the varieties? That's the economy is a dimension. Well, what are the most important distinctions on that dimension? We have different kinds of economies. And then the third step is to say, which of these types best describes the United States? First, you have to think about what are the relevant dimensions. Secondly, you have to think about what are the types on that dimension. And third, aha, now we're ready to locate this particular society with respect to that dimension by finding out its type. Now, the chapter on this contains, I think, 10 different dimensions around which you can analyze American society. I'm not going to here in the lecture discuss all of them. I'll just focus on a number, and the rest you can just cover by reading it in the chapter itself. Here are the 10 that are in the book, 10 dimensions on which societies vary. Technology, the economy, economic inequality, political institutions, the role of the military, gender relations, social cleavages, immigration, culture, and violence as a characteristic of a society. But of course, you don't have to write all of these. Are all listed in the chapter too, so don't feel you have to scribble all of these down in your notes. Of course, there are many other dimensions. What would you suggest? I'm just interested. Some thoughts from the floor. In addition to these 10, let's just spend a few minutes thinking about other dimensions. What other dimension? Somebody. Yeah. Religion. Okay, sure. Religion. Society certainly vary in religion. If we were to think about the United States in terms of religion, before we try to locate the United States, religion is a dimension. What would be the types on that dimension? What would be examples of different kinds of, different ways you would classify a society in terms of this dimension, religion? Some suggestions, yeah. Okay, so one aspect of this would be frequency of attendance or observance. You know, there'd be different ways you could actually play that out. And other things, yeah. Okay, let's call that the density of religious institutions. Other, yeah, in the back, you, red shirt. The number of gods. Okay, so let's call that, the more general thing would be the kind of theology. Mono, poly, etc. Yeah, pink shirt. Okay, church, state, relations. That's certainly one way that societies vary that's connected to the religious dimension. Yeah. Okay, so we could call that tolerance, let's say, religious tolerance. So some places could be seen as very tolerant and others as very intolerant. There was somebody who, yeah, I started to answer, yeah. Okay, so yeah, so that's an interesting, that's, this, let's call that religious pluralism. That is, some countries, almost everybody can be classified as participating in a single religion. Others are very heterogeneous, very pluralistic in their religious affiliations. One more, yeah. Okay, that's an interesting. It was the nature of the religious or priestly class, I guess. But I think one could talk about two issues here. Are religious people isolated from non-religious? That's one kind of division of or segregation. And the other is there a priestly class that's separated from the rest of the population? So let's call that kind of integration, separation, or something like that. You know, we're not here working on fine tuning the way we're thinking about it. So you can see there's lots of. Now, what would you say for the United States? Okay, you've lived here, most of you. If you were to locate the United States on the dimension of religion. You know, somebody arrives from a different planet and they say, I hear religion is an important thing on this planet. How would you describe the United States in terms of some of these categories? We don't have to go through all of them, but just to give you a sense. Yeah. So the U.S. is, so it's very religious. So it's out on one end of the spectrum. If we have a spectrum that asks how religious, on average, are the people in a country? Because when you say a country is religious, you really mean the people in the country are religious. On most measures, the United States is pretty far out on the religiosity scale. Here's an interesting factoid. There are more, a higher percentage of the population in Saudi Arabia are atheists than in the United States. As the United States, in terms of this very simple measure of religiosity, the belief in God, on that particular dimension, we're actually way, way out on the extreme in terms of people who say, yes, I don't believe in God. In the United States, I think it's somewhere in the vicinity of 10 or 12%. In Saudi Arabia, it's somewhere in the vicinity of 15 or 18%. A couple of other thoughts as to where you would locate the United States. Yeah?
We have
freedom of practice. Freedom of practice. So we are, the United States is pretty tolerant of diversity. You know, sometimes the tolerance gets a little frayed around the edges. The attack on the Sikh temple, the shocking attack in Milwaukee, is an example of intolerance. But that really was shocking because it is so exceptional. The Americans are remarkably tolerant. I would say even under the stresses of the last decade, after 9/11, you might have expected a much harsher reaction against Muslim Americans. There was some intolerance around Islam, intensified, of course, as one would expect. But actually, it's a tribute to religious pluralism in the United States that it's been relatively muted compared to what one might have expected under these conditions. This, by the way, is one of the, just so you don't think I'm a never-ending nasty critic of American society, this is one of the things I deeply value about American society, is its tolerance, its relatively relaxed attitude towards very, very different kinds of religious beliefs, which is a very strong and positive thing here. Let's just see if someone else, yeah. Secular government. So this is a kind of interesting one, a pretty contested one. It's true that the United States has separation of church and state as part of its constitution, and a long tradition of identifying itself as having a secular government. On the other hand, on our currency, it says, "In God we trust." And the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag says, "One nation under God." And it's pretty tough for a public figure to stand up and say, religion has no place in public, in official public life. The prayer, the constitutional ban on prayer in school was very controversial and remains so. So it's true we have a secular government, but in many ways, ironically, the government is less secular than in some countries that have an established religion. Sweden, the Lutheran Church is established. It's paid for by taxes in Sweden. And yet the Swedish government does way less to promote religion, to be sympathetic to religion, than in the US. Well, this is enough, I think, for this point. This is just to illustrate this idea that you can classify countries, and then there's a lot to talk about, and how you understand the specificity of one country depends upon how you locate it with respect to a spectrum. Yeah. I include it as one of the items under culture. That is, culture is a very broad dimension. There are many aspects of culture And one of the distinctive things of American culture is its religiosity. So that's where I've located it. But this is not some, to kind of stretch our metaphor, this isn't a sacred list. It's not meant to be, even though it has 10, right? It's not 10 commandments. This is how you classify societies. One could certainly make a good argument that you might want to put religion here as a standalone dimension because of its salience and not just see it as one aspect of culture. Okay, let's spend as much time as we have left on some points that I think we should emphasize. First, technology. This is a good candidate if you were in a position that, you know, somebody arrives from Mars or, you know, some more plausible planet where somebody could arrive from another galaxy, right? So somebody's arrived and they say, you can give me one piece of information about a country, about a place on Earth that will convey a lot of information about how people live, about what it's like. The technology of a country, of a society, is a pretty good candidate. If you could only have one piece of information about a society, and from that one piece of information you are then going to derive all sorts of expectations, technology would be a pretty good candidate. Right? Knowing that a society gathers its food by hunting and gathering, but not by farming, that it has this very limited technology to transform nature into food, that they do it by hunting and gathering, if you simply knew that, you would also know all sorts of other things. You could make pretty good guesses about a lot of those other attributes just from knowing something about their technology. So technology is certainly one of the things that you'd want to know. There are all sorts of ways that technologies vary. So technology is a kind of umbrella term that covers all sorts of things. Here are two important ways that technologies vary. So one way that technologies vary is in their productivity. Productivity. Now that's an important word. You hear it a lot. It's important to have a pretty good idea of what is meant when you say you have a more or less productive technology. We'll be talking more about this in some subsequent lectures. Basically, what productivity means is how much time and resources does it take to produce something. High productivity means you use less time and resources to produce whatever it is you're producing than low productivity. Increasing productivity means you can produce the same amount of stuff with less inputs or more stuff with the same inputs. Often people talk about labor productivity because they're mostly interested in how much time do people have to spend doing something. So it is crucial, because we care about people and about how much our time gets taken up with different activities. That's a very important dimension of productivity, but it's not the only one. You could talk about the energy productivity. How many kilowatts of energy does it take to produce something? And you can improve the productivity with respect to energy by improving your technology as well. Mostly, however, when productivity is just used as a general loose term, it refers to how much human time it takes to produce something. So here's just some simple examples. In 1750, it took a lot longer to produce a given amount of yarn than it does today. Yarn is a nice example because the actual yarn that gets produced, there are types of yarn that are, in terms of the product, the same now as in 1750. So that's an example of something that you can compare directly. How many hours does it take to produce 100 yards of yarn in 1750 compared to now? So I just like some guesses. how many multiples of the present time would it take to produce any given quantity of yarn? Just some wild guesses. In 1750 compared to today, how much longer? Somebody, just yell out an... Five? We have between 5 and 10,000. It's actually pretty, it's sort of in between. 1,430. It took 1,430 times as long to produce the same amount of yarn in 1750 as it does today. Think about agriculture. Now this is mind-boggling. 250 years ago, mid-18th century, it took 70% of the population spending their time producing food to feed 100% of the population. So that's one way of thinking about this. How many people have to devote their time and effort to producing food so that everybody can eat? Today, it's less than 3%. That's, you know, astounding. 3% of the population in the United States produce more than enough food for 311 million people. Because we're a net exporter of food. It takes only 3% of the population to produce that much food. That's a fantastic increase in productivity. Just an amazing increase in productivity. And as you can see, it's an amazing increase of productivity that allows all sorts of things to happen that would not otherwise be able to happen. One of the things that enables to happen is for all of you to come to university. It would be simply impossible for 50% of the young cohort, or whatever it is these days, you know, of people in their late teens and early 20s to take time off from farming to go to university if it takes 70% of the population to produce the food for 100% of the population. So one of the things that increases the productivity does is open up the possibility of other ways of spending your time, including spending your time learning, as opposed to just spending your time producing. Increases of productivity open up human possibility. And that's why it's been given so much attention, why it's such a fundamental way that societies vary. A second way that technologies vary is cost. You know, a given technology can be very expensive or really cheap. This affects all sorts of human possibilities. The information technology revolution of the past several decades has resulted in a massive reduction of costs for certain kinds of activities. Just an extraordinary reduction of costs. And this has just monumental consequences for human potential, for what we can do with our lives. I mean, you all surf the web. You all know how easy it is to get information. 15 years ago, the idea of producing something like Wikipedia, producing a global encyclopedia that's free to everybody, would have been just simply unthinkable. It would be impossible to imagine how you could get several hundred thousand people around the world to cooperate to freely edit a free encyclopedia that would be made available to everybody. There would be have been no way to do that without this super inexpensive technology, computers as we know them today. So a key theme that we're going to be pursuing in this semester, one of the ideas that drives some of the critical analysis I'm proposing, is that the United States has achieved extraordinary levels of productivity that open up new human possibilities. But we have not used this extraordinary productivity in a way that enhances the overall well-being of large numbers of our population. We have not used our expanded productivity in a way that benefits all. There's a potential for a kind of emancipation of human potential, and that potential itself has not been realized because of the way our institutions are organized. Our institutions, in a way, I will argue, squander the human liberation that's created by our productivity. The economy. The first part of the course focuses on the economy. And I know that that's going to be painful for some of you. I have periodically gotten comments that they from students that they thought they were enrolling in a sociology course, not an economics course, because we will be spending a fair amount of time talking about how the economy works, since it is such an important aspect of American society. I like to say the economy is way too important to leave to economists. It's important for sociologists to study the economy as well. But we, in doing so, we have to explore some of the ideas that comes from the discipline of economics. So the United States, the economy is one of the ways that we can define American society. We have a particular kind of economy. It's an economy that's generally referred to as a capitalist economy, capitalism. Capitalism is one of many different varieties of economic structures. Some societies are not capitalist. Some societies are historically were organized in a way that's described as feudal. Other societies were based on slavery. Some societies have been their economies have been organized by the state, not by the market. So capitalism is a very specific kind of economy, and that's what we'll be talking about starting next week. So next week's lectures are really about how an economy works when it's a capitalist economy and how we should think about the American economy in those terms. Capitalism is not just a market economy. Sometimes people think of capitalism and markets are as identical. It's not simply a market economy. You can have a market economy that's not a capitalist economy. It's not just a market economy, it's a special kind of market economy. Again, this is another one of these classification issues, right? We've got mammals, but not all mammals are mice. We have mammals that are mice and mammals that are whales. Well, we have market economies, and some of them are capitalist and some of them are not. Capitalism is a particular kind of market economy. It's one in which the enterprises are privately owned and run on the basis of maximizing profits. So you could have a market economy in which all the enterprises were cooperatives. They were all owned by the employees collectively. And in which they weren't run to maximize profits, they were run to maximize the welfare of the members of the co-op. Maximizing the well-being of the members of a co-op is a different logic than maximizing the monetary profits of a firm, because monetary profits are only one of the things that determine the well-being of the members of a co-op. So in capitalism, enterprises are privately owned and run for profits, and people who don't own enterprises earn their living by going on a labor market and selling their labor to employers. We'll be spending a lot of time talking about that in the weeks to come. Well, we're capitalism, but what kind of capitalism? Capitalism comes in many flavors. Japan is a capitalist country. Sweden is a capitalist country. France is a capitalist country. There are many different flavors of capitalism. What kind of capitalism is the United States? Well, again, this is something we'll be talking about in some detail in the weeks to come. Just to give you then a preview, I would describe the American form of capitalism with the expression hyper-capitalism. We are pretty much on the extreme end of the continuum in terms of how capitalistic is our capitalism. We are a kind of hyper-capitalism. What does that mean? We're a capitalism made up of very powerful corporations, huge enterprises with enormous levels of power, operate within the kind of capitalism we have. Here's a nice little factoid, you know, these little nuggets of facts that are, I think, startling. The top 10 United States industrial corporations, so we're not talking about banks, we're talking about industrial corporations. The top 10 in the United States in 2008 would have been the eighth largest economy in the world if they were a country. They would have ranked just after Italy. So you have eight countries ending, you have seven countries ending in Italy, and the eighth country would be the 10 largest industrial corporations in the United States. Not all capitalisms are dominated by large corporations. We are a kind of capitalism that is. Secondly, we have extremely weak unions. Unions, that is, the organizations of workers to form collective organizations to defend their interests, are weaker in the United States than in almost any other developed capitalist country. And they've been weakened considerably more in recent years. That was the whole political struggle in Wisconsin over the past 2 years, was over the, at least so far, successful efforts of the state government to destroy public sector unions. Not just weaken them, but to destroy them. We are a country of very weak unions. Now, here's something which might seem surprising to some of you. We're also a country with relatively little public regulation of markets. Now, we do have regulations. You know, we have health and safety regulations. We have environmental regulations. We have all sorts of product safety regulations. You can't produce toasters that blow up in people's kitchens. There are rules that govern how electrical circuits have to be built in electrical appliances. So we do have food safety regulations. But compared to other countries, so again, on the spectrum of possible capitalisms, we're at the low regulation end of the spectrum, not the high regulation end of the spectrum. Among market economies, capitalist market economies, in the rich part of the world, in the 25 or 30 richest countries, we have among the weakest regulations of our economy. We also have the lowest level of taxation. We're not a high-tax country. We already have the lowest levels of taxation among developed countries. And therefore, the idea that the reason why we have economic difficulties is that our taxes are too high just is not plausible, given that we already have the lowest taxes of any country in the developed part of the world. And we are a capitalism that has very high levels of inequality. Now, capitalism as an economic structure always produces inequality. You know, markets, when they're unregulated and they're organized around private firms, tend to generate inequality because advantages tend to accumulate. You know, the rich get richer because they have advantages by virtue of their wealth. So capitalism, as a general matter, tends to produce inequality. American capitalism produces the highest inequality of any capitalism in the developed part of the world. We have higher, as we will see in the middle part of the course, we have higher levels of economic inequality than any other country. That then takes us to the next item on our list, what kind of a country we are. We are a country with extraordinary high levels of inequality. Around 21% of children live below the poverty line in the United States. The richest 1% of households have 190 times more wealth than the median household. The word median, I hope all of you know what that means, but just in case you don't, if you ranked all households in the United States from the household with the least wealth to the household with the most wealth, and we had just a rank ordered list. So I don't know offhand how many households there are in the United States. It's probably in the vicinity of 150 million, let's say. Let's, for argument's sake, there's 150 million households. The median is the household that would be at the 75 million point on that list of 150 million. The median is not the average household, it's the household that's in the middle of the list. Well, the top 1% of households own 190 times more than the household in the middle. And things have gotten much more unequal in the past few decades. These are all things which we'll be spending a lot of time talking about in the middle part, especially in the middle part of the semester. Is this a bad thing? Well, there's an argument to be made. Some people argue that there's nothing wrong with inequality, that inequality is actually a good thing, not a bad thing, because it provides motivations for people. Well, this is something we'll have to check out when we get to that part of the course. One of the things we're going to look very closely at is the so what question. Should we really care about inequality or not? Does it really matter for the lives of people that we have this level of inequality? I believe it does matter. I think it's tremendously harmful in all sorts of ways, but that's something I'll have to defend. That's not something which should be taken for granted. Political institutions. The U.S. has a democratic form of government. We are, by every analysis that I know of, considered among the family of democratic societies. But we have what I would describe as a relatively thin democracy. So we have a democracy, but it's a thin rather than a deep democracy. And here will be the key theme that we'll be exploring. As a society, we spend more money on political competition than any other. So you'd think, in a way, if we spend more money on our political life, on the politics of political competition, we should end up with a more robust democracy. But it just doesn't end up that way. We spend more money, but it yields only a thin form of democracy. Why? We will be investigating the actual rules of the game, how our democracy works, and why it works in a way that undermines rather than strengthens its democratic quality. Now, when I say this, it's because I am evaluating democracy in terms of the core values that I think democracy should achieve. And that's, if you recall from the previous lecture, I define democracy as a political system in which public decisions are made as a result of the collective will of equal citizens participating in forming that collective will. And it's because of that process by which public decisions get made that I think our democracy has ended up being a thin democracy. The military and global power. Here's the key theme that we'll be exploring. Among countries in the world, we can array them on a spectrum in terms of how much of their national resources are devoted to military purposes and how big a role they play militarily in affecting other societies and other places in the world. The United States, in these terms, is a relatively militaristic society and has generally adopted a militarily aggressive policy internationally. The U.S. has intervened militarily in more countries since the Second World War than any other nation by a large order of magnitude. Now, describing the United States as a militaristic society will be controversial. Not everyone feels that that's a reasonable way of describing how the role of the military. It is certainly the case that we have civilian government. It is not the case, as it has been in some places and sometimes in places in the world, it is not the case that our government is run by the military. So in that respect, we have a civilian state, not a military state. But it's a civilian state in which a huge amount of energy and resources is devoted specifically to military projects. And we will analyze why that's the case and how it differs from other contemporary societies. Gender. Gender is a way that we can describe different societies. If you think about a place like Saudi Arabia, it's a male-dominated society in which, remarkably, women have only recently been given the right to drive cars. It's not just that they don't have the right to vote. They weren't even allowed to have driver's licenses. The United States, so that's one extreme of a male-dominated society. The United States is one of a family of countries which has had an absolutely extraordinary transformation of gender relations in the last half century or so. You are all living in the midst of what I would consider the most rapid transformation of a fundamental structure of society in human history. The speed with which gender relations have been transformed is greater than the speed with which the Industrial Revolution transformed manufacturing, how we produce things. This is an extraordinary transformation, and it's one of the themes that we will be exploring. One more minute. Social cleavage. The key theme that we'll be exploring around social cleavages will center around the issue of race. Racial inequality and racial cleavage remains a deep and serious reality of American life in spite of the great progress that's been made in the last half century. Around race, I'm going to be emphasizing the persistence of the forms of racial inequality and racial domination that exist in the United States. I'm going to emphasize that, although of course I will also talk about the transformations that have occurred, because I think we've come to a point where for many Americans, especially white Americans, there's a belief that racial domination is really a thing of the past, that this has become not a central reality in American life, and we will spend quite a bit of time focusing on the nature of how race works in American society today. And the rest of these items on culture, well, I guess there's only one left on my PowerPoint. You can read in the chapter and see on the PowerPoint, you can see on the website. I hope to see at least some of you at the bike ride, and otherwise I'll see you next Tuesday. Thanks very much.